Entrepreneurs out there, can the Paychecks and Balances audience benefit from your product or service? Do you want to increase awareness of your side hustle? Well, guess what? We're here to help. We want to support our entrepreneurial listeners with an opportunity to advertise on the podcast without breaking the bank. Because as we all know, the struggle is real. So to learn more about how you can reach thousands of listeners, visit paychecksandbalances.com/smallbusiness. Again, paychecksandbalances.com/smallbusiness. We've made it super easy, so check it out. Now on with the show. Hey, what's good? This is Rich.
I'm Marcus.
And you're listening to the Paychecks and Balances podcast, where we take a fun, formative approach to work and money with the hope we don't leave you dazed, confused, or befuddled.
And you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at PayBalances and on Facebook at Paychecks and Balances, all words. I slow down for Facebook because it's Facebook.
Yeah, I was kind of wondering what was going on there. I was like, this looks pretty simple to me. Is this man okay? But it seems you're fine. So anyway, if you've been enjoying the show, consider becoming a financial supporter on Patreon by visiting paychecksandbalances.com/patron. Some of the perks for the PNB patrons include early access to ad-free episodes, access to our private Facebook community and video chats, along with priority status in our question queue. So to learn more, again, that link is paychecksandbalances.com/patron.
Just to clarify, I might be back on my anti-Facebook rant, but maybe I'll hold that for another show if that was unclear to folks. I don't think it's unclear to folks about why I would get off Facebook, but I'm on the cusp right now, so I won't bore y'all with that. Today, we're joined by Mark Miller. Mark's career includes 22 years with IBM tech startups, and he was also a high school math teacher, which I wanted to explore a little bit today. He also learned that most people don't know what makes them happy. I think that's a familiar script that we talk about on the show. So he now uses his experience to help people find their happy place. So we're happy to have him on the show. Thanks for joining us, Mark.
Hey, thank you for having me on here.
So I hit a few of the points. Is there anything else about your background that you'd like to share with the people that you think would be important?
Yeah, I'm a recovering engineer. Yeah, there's a 12-step program for that. I've been accused of being a recovering job seeker. I can't ever hold a job. So I'm on my seventh career. Wow. So yeah, that's why I started Career Pivot, because I can't stay in a career very long.
I saw that and I thought that was pretty interesting because we're going to talk a little bit about this today. You know, generationally, we're supposed to be the ones that are always jumping for careers. And I guess I've had one career with three different organizations. I don't know how to count that. Is it like, is a career change a true, like, you know, shedding of the skin coming out like a butterfly type of thing? Or is it moving organizations, or is it one and the same? Or do you say like you were working at Walmart and now you're like a tech CEO? Like what's a career change entail?
Well, I've spent the first 22 years at IBM, and back when I started my career in the late 70s, most of the big companies wanted you to make these shifts or pivots every few years because they like generalists. Starting in about the 1990s, there was a shift from generalization to specialists. And I'm a generalist. I mean, I started out as a programmer, ended up moving into IT, ended up as a trainer. Then I crossed to the dark side, went into sales, went into marketing. I spent my last year or so of all things at IBM Global Services as a consultant, which I hated. And so it's making those shifts where it used to be people like that. Now it's everyone wants everyone to be deeply ingrained in some specialty, and it becomes a lot more difficult, particularly as you'll guys figure out as you get married and have kids and buy a house. You got to maintain an income.
Interesting.
And so making those shifts becomes progressively more difficult.
Got it. So it's interesting you say that, because with this generation, we talk about there's a lot of talk about the whole lack of loyalty. People move around every couple of years, whereas with previous generations, I'm not sure if that was just boomers or whatever came after that. I think it was X. There was this idea of loyalty. You worked the same place 20, 30 years, but you mentioned people, them wanting people to make these shifts or changes every few years, which sounds a little bit different from what we hear people talk about today.
Yeah, it's rather interesting. I do a multi-generational workplace talk. And one of the things, I've got this great infographic that most of the millennials are Gen Y. You actually look at yourself as being quite loyal. And we go, loyal? What do you mean loyal? You shift jobs every few years. Well, the difference is, yeah, you'll be loyal if your employer is loyal to you.
Yeah, I could see that because I feel like that's lost now.
When the employers screwed us, and by the way, I'm 60, we stayed loyal. So why do you do that? Well, you know what? We told you to, right? To a large extent, most of the Gen Y or millennials, you do what we wish we had done. Mm. And the reason why you do it is because we told you to. We told you to ask for what you want. Told you if you weren't happy to go switch. And as an employer, when I have to manage you, it pisses me off.
I was going to ask you that. So when you were moving through those various careers, was that by chance or were you chasing money or did that just happen?
I guess you would refer to me as, there's a term called a multi-potentialite. I get bored easily. So I'm always looking to do the next thing. And so I would make a pivot every 3 years. Now, when I say making a pivot, it wasn't like, well, it's even like me going, I've spent a lot of my career learning and development. So I was a trainer. Then moving into teaching high school math, well, that, by the way, teaching adolescents is totally different than teaching adults.
Oh, I'm sure.
But I use the same skill sets. It's similar now. I'm a coach, but coming out of learning and development, I just train. So yes, it's different, but I'm using the same skill sets.
So I do want to ask, because I hear this a lot, and I'm a product of the public school system. Not sure if that's a good or a bad thing, but I do hear that, high school and by some extension, college doesn't prepare or does an inadequate job of preparing students for either or possibly both becoming entrepreneurs or workers. Do you think that's an accurate statement? And then if so, like, what is that gap and why does that gap exist?
Oh, heck yes. It does not prepare. I mean, in 2002, I was working for a startup. I had a major bicycle accident. I hit a car head on at 50 miles an hour. Our combined speeds exceeded 50 miles an hour. And I lived. And the following year, I laid myself off and I got I got a math teaching certificate from Austin Community College. And what I discovered when I got into teaching school was, wow, I was teaching algebra 2 and nothing had changed. I mean, nothing. I was teaching logarithms and I'm going, why? When I went to school.
Wait, you said logarithms?
Logarithms.
I don't even remember. I'm not going to ask. I don't remember what that was.
Well, we needed it back in the 70s. I needed to know logs because that's how slide rules worked. There's no reason to teach. Basically, the curriculum you see in math in high schools was created in 1890, and nothing has changed.
That's kind of crazy to hear.
Okay.
I was going to go with terrifying, but crazy works.
The other piece is, you end up going into the school system, and the experienced teachers have never experienced working at a real job. They don't know what the real world looks like. And as you're discovering, the world of work is changing rapidly. Hmm. I get briefed every year by Texas Workforce Commission about the top 10 jobs in Texas. And by the way, six to eight of them didn't exist 5 years ago. Hmm. So how can you prepare? This is both from a high school perspective, prepare them for jobs or careers, much less someplace like the University of Texas, which is a giant battleship, and they don't prepare either.
So you're saying that both high school teachers and even maybe at the collegiate level, these are folks who've never actually worked in the workforce, who are preparing people to be in the workforce outside of academia.
Correct. If you look at, I deal a lot with, I do a lot of talks for a group here in Austin that deals with the kids that are coming out of the PR department at UT, the communications, and they're not prepared to go into the workforce. The other difference is when I was raised, I got my first job when I was 12 or 13. I have a 32-year-old son. We didn't ask him to go get a real job until he was 18 or 19. So one of the differences, I was raised to get an employment resume. Most of y'all were raised to get a college resume.
I could see that.
Right. And so we get a lot of folks, I deal with a lot of startups here in Austin, and they get kids coming out of college who've never had a real job. They've had internships, but internships aren't real jobs. So they don't know how to be employees.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I was thinking about the internship piece because when I was in school, I had a couple. I think when I was a teenager, I think my first job was like picking up dog poop in a park or something like that. And then I did some other customer service stuff. You know, so I did have a few jobs, but it sounds like even that's changing where people are going longer in their adolescent years without having any employment or getting any experience under their belt until they're actually at the point of being in college.
Yeah. And even very often, and a lot of this depends on what kind of college they go to. I'll use example here locally, the kids who are going down to Texas State versus the kids going to UT, the kids at Texas State are largely paying their way through college. They're working. Mm-hmm. A lot of the folks who are going to University of Texas, the parents, they got scholarships, and they don't have to work. And one of the challenges is when they come out, we have a lot of boomers and Gen Xers, bosses who going, you know, we're going to treat them like they're us. And by the way, they're nothing like you.
Oh, well, I guess that would explain some of the hostility between the generations.
Oh, yes. Well, give you an idea. Generation X, those born. Well, let me explain. Generational echo effects. When everyone leaves home, you do one of two things. You either do exactly what your parents told you to do, or you do the exact opposite. And rarely anything in between. Mm-hmm. Because either you say, I ain't going to do that like mom and dad, or I'm going to do like mom and dad. The other way to explain this is you ask anybody who's raising kids, and you ask them, are you raising your children the same way you were raised? And the answer is not just no, it's usually hell no. So why would you expect them to be like you?
This has been... Yeah, like the reason I haven't been able to comment, and I apologize to the listeners, because I've been over here reflecting myself as a hiring manager now and also in the role that Rich plays, at least as a liaison for hiring managers. And I tell him that he's going to join the dark side of hiring managers sooner or later, whether he likes it or not.
I'm hiring people right now, and I'm already feeling it, bro.
Well, through the void of hiring managers leaving, you're going to come to this side anyway. So we can have that Darth Vader conversation heart to heart one day because it needs to take place. But for some reason, I was looking at it that exact same way. And I'm a Generation Y, but I've been working since I was 16. So I had probably three or four jobs before I joined, quote unquote, the workforce post college. But yeah, when you're explaining that now, some of these people that I may very well have hired or that I'm working with, and maybe I've been working with for years and just never really thought of it that way, this was literally their first job. So people have said that to me, like, oh, remember, this is their first job. This is their first job. And I'm thinking, oh, yeah, it's their first career. But this might literally be their first 9-to-5 job. Because there's definitely been some misalignments in my expectation and theirs. I think I'm more nimble. At least I hope. I don't know if my employers are listening to this show, but I hope I'm more mentally nimble because I'm just used to change. So I just try to navigate that in real time. But I could definitely see that conflict of, okay, you expect somebody to work a certain way because that's what you've done. And, you know, everyone that you know has worked since 14, 15, 13, and in my case, 16. But it never really clicked for me that this might literally be someone's first 40-hour workplace job. Like that was crazy to me. I don't know if anyone else is having an aha moment, but that was my aha moment for this show.
I was definitely staring at the ceiling, reflecting quietly.
Yeah, this is one of those things that you have to look at. Every generation does these shifts. So I'll use the example, my parents' generation, my father was served in World War II. Every male in his generation, the greatest generation, served in the military, was loyal to the government. And my generation, we went through Vietnam and Watergate. We didn't trust the government worth crap. And that's where we're seeing, again, we're seeing with Gen Y, you're much more in tune with the government. Similarly, my parents knew how to save money. My parents grew up through the Depression. You know, they knew, understood deprivation. They understood rationing going through World War II. My generation, we spent money like crazy. The most important technological change that affected our generation was 1969. Visa credit cards.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, and the other technological effect to us was 1965, birth control.
I could see that impacting some things.
Well, if you look at the birth rate charts, and I use this in my workshop, birth rates leveled out and have declined ever since. Oh, by the way, divorce rate starting in 65 started to soar and didn't cap off until in the mid-1990s. So this is where those of the Depression era, those between the silent generation born between 25 and 45, had a very high divorce rate. Those of Gen X, who are typically 35 to 50 now, have the lowest divorce rate. They don't get married.
Yeah, I was reading an article the other day, and I realized, and I was going to tweet this, that the news report statistics, something to the effect of getting married increases your chance of getting divorced 100%. Like, that's how they use statistics. And I'm like, when you finally start looking, I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. But it was a Time article, and it said divorces are down. And I was like, divorces are down for like the first time in, you know, last 60 years or something like that, the lowest rate. I'm like, oh, wow. So I click in there. And they're down because either no one's getting married or people are marrying later. And I'm like, these freaking headlines. But no. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, very true. It's and it's a combination of, if you saw your parents divorced, and by the way, those of Gen X, half of them grew up in single parent households. So why would you go get married?
Okay.
Right. Similar, and this is why Gen X and Gen Y don't get along. Gen X grew up in, half of them grew up in single parent households, very resilient. Many of them put themselves through college. And what do we do with you kids? And by the way, your kids, I'm going to be your father, is we coddled you. Everyone, you know, everyone got a trophy. Everyone got a blue ribbon.
Don't talk about trophies with this man, Marcus, on the line.
Yeah, I hate those participation trophies.
That's what we did. We started working very young, so we didn't want you. My generation was very private. Your generation created Facebook.
Yeah, you know, and as we're having this conversation, and we talk about how, you know, each generation tells their kids not to be a certain way or to be a certain way, and then when they do that, they hate it. I'm sitting here thinking about what I would tell my kids or what the next generation would look like. Because if we're all already feeling free, we want to have meaning, we want to do our own thing, is like the next generation just going to be complete anarchy?
Well, the point is, they will, as I said, to some extent, they will do what, be like you. In other ways, they will be the opposite. I graduated from college and I went to work for IBM because that was the nice, safe way. I mean, I claim I was raised to be an employee, to go work for a father-like company that would take care of me. And of course, they moved my cheese. But, you know, my kids, you know, our kids, we've told them to follow your passion. The money will follow. Of course, that didn't work either. But it's, again, how you end up raising your kids they're usually a mirror of who you are.
Okay.
And so therefore, you know, one of the problems with the millennials is we've told them, you know, we see this with tech startups here in Austin. you'll have a 40-year-old manager, and you'll tell the 25-year-old, you need to come to work at 8 o'clock. And the kid will go, why? Because I told you to. And the kid will go, why? Why is he asking why? Well, that's the way we raised him. We raised him to question everything.
Yeah, I've definitely seen that. I've actually had that exact conversation because I feel some type of way about 8 o'clock. I just feel generally some type of way about waking up for any activity before about 9 or 10, which is when my energy kicks in anyway. Like if you have to drink coffee in order to do the activity, then maybe the activity is set too early. That's just my thought.
Well, one of the I'm affiliated with a nonprofit here, Launchpad Job Club, and our sponsor is Indeed. And I asked, Indeed comes out to our meetings every month, every week, I mean. And I asked Brendan, the lead guy out there, I said, when do your kids, his younger employees, come to work? He says, well, I drop my kids off at school about 8:30 and I'm in. And he says, you know, they start showing up 9:30, 10 o'clock. He says, but I can text them any time of day and night and they'll respond.
So I've heard about a workforce like this. I mean, it might be my cousin. Someone was telling me, they're like, yeah, I just go in. I'm like, at what time? Like, I have a prescribed time to be at work. It's literally in this. Now, mind you, we're auditors, and of course, we need everything by the book and black and white and all that. But yeah, I guess it was my friend. I can't hear me. It was so mind boggling. I couldn't even, like, I like zoned out, blacked out. But they were like, yeah, I just go in. And they didn't have a start time. They just go in. When their eyes open, they go in.
So I see that a lot out here in the Bay Area with the engineers. Like some of them, sometimes it's like, yeah, that person comes in at 11. I'm like, wait, 11 a.m.? They're like, yeah, like, don't put anything on their meeting before 11 a.m. I'm like, what life is this? You know, because I can't live that life. But I'm seeing a lot more flexibility where you see someone, they may work from 11 to 7, or they can access whatever they need from home or from a work shuttle. And so there's a lot more flexibility about when they're expected to be around and even what it means to be present.
Yeah, I use the example of my son, who's probably a year or two younger than you two guys. He went off to college, and the first thing they did was they handed him a laptop, and he could plug it in anywhere. And this was pre-Wi-Fi days. But today, you know, you can work from anywhere. And so therefore, and they've gone through college that way.
Now, sorry, it's coming full circle. Okay, I see it now.
Right. So the expectation of, well, I can work from anywhere. So as long as I get my job done, why do you care? And I'll use an example at my last startup, Lifesize. I had an employee who had worked for me at my first startup, and she had 3 kids at home, and I let her work from home. I didn't care. And she worked 20 hours a week for me, and it drove my boss nuts. He wanted to see her. I said, I don't need to see her. I know she'll get her job done. And there are certain expectations by certain of us who are a little bit older that you're supposed to come to work. You are supposed to be someplace at a certain time, whether it makes any sense or not.
Yeah, I've seen that a lot. Now I'm purposely hesitating. Might even have to cut this out the show completely because we try not to go viral on Friday, be fired on Monday. But yeah, I've more or less literally had to overcome the mindset more often than I had the technology. I've worked in several offices where we all had the technology to work from home, but there was just this expectation that I need to physically see you in your cubicle or office space for 8 hours a day. And I've told Rich about this, and I think he can relate. I think anyone can relate. You know, that's fine. I mean, there are days, and I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this. There's days where I have 8 hours of work, and there's days where I have 12 hours of work, and there's 16 hours. But every now and then, there's a day where I don't have 8 hours of work. And thus, I find work, I guess. I'll just say that I don't have 8 hours of work, yet I have 8 hours of expectation to sit in my cubicle and or office place for that full breadth of 8 hours. That does not make sense to me.
And yes, the way work today, how work looks today is changing dramatically. My second tech startup was a high definition video conferencing startup. This is you know, pre-Skype. And I was amazed at the number of people when I left that I knew really well who were all over the world. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's happening is, you know, we are competing. Your job, you are competing with people all over the world. Mm. And I'll keep this not
before.
Oh, no. So let's use the example. I about a month ago, I lost my keys in Zilker Park and I couldn't get back into my condo. And so I called a 24-hour lock service. I got on my iPhone, found it, called them. The woman told me that someone would be contacting me within, you know, 15 minutes. Gentleman called me, said, I'll be there in 15 minutes. He showed up. Okay. The fellow who actually came out to drill out my lock, he was located about 3 miles from me. By the way, the woman I talked to was in India. Mm. So any job that does not require face-to-face customer interaction now can be moved anywhere. It can be location independent.
I would imagine for depending on the country, a lower cost because of all the dynamics of what you would have to pay that individual to come physically sit in that office and or cubicle space for 8 hours.
So if you go to an accountant today and you say, I've got taxes, you know, once you do my tax return, the odds are if it's something more than trivial, like going to H&R Block, they will ship it to India. You know, my son, his brother-in-law is a fashion photographer. And I asked him one day, I said, well, what does a typical day for you look like? Well, we take all these pictures. We then throw them up onto the screen. We look at them. We adjust the lighting. We take the pictures again. And then we ship them to India to be photoshopped.
It's interesting you say that because I've been thinking about outsourcing, even some things as it relates to this here podcast and to create, you know, more free time for myself to focus on things that I think will create more impact. And so there's these sites like Fiverr out there where you can get pretty much any task done starting at $5. And so as we're having this conversation, I'm thinking about how much additional competition that creates, because now versus, you know, having to go through the process of finding someone domestically, you're right. I could find anybody across the world to be able to do this task for, you know, pretty much a fee that's going to work within my budget. And so it's creating this additional competition for people who have been doing it for a while. And I'd actually be curious to get your thoughts on that. So there are the folks, they may have went to school for a program and now they find themselves competing globally on more of a price basis versus a formal skill and training basis. And so now we have this ultra competitive landscape that's out there today.
Oh, very much so. The profession that has the highest unemployment rate in the country is lawyers.
I would not have thought that.
We are still spitting out lawyers from our law schools at the same rate or higher than we did 15, 20 years ago. And a lot of the legal work can be done overseas at less cost. Mm. You know, so you're looking at, and for someone like myself, I'm a 60-year-old entrepreneur now. I have a virtual assistant. She happens to live in Indiana. She could be anywhere. My editor and my webmaster, and I never see them.
And so is your expectation is just they do good work and that's that?
If as long as they do good work, we communicate, we come up with a system to communicate between Skype, Dropbox, and various other tools, we can work just fine. And I don't need to know where they are. It's more important to deal with time zones than it is location.
And the reason I ask is, I guess, twofold. I told Rich when I was putting the book together, I felt like a miniature Steve Jobs. Like, it blew my mind. You know, Rich is always, I'm the non-adapter. Rich is always the early adapter. So I usually discover something right before it's going out of style. Like, so I joined Facebook in 2014. And as you heard, I'm thinking about leaving. Like, I'm that guy. And so when I was on Fiverr, the cover editor, I want to say Pakistan, the guy that edited my photo that appears on the book was definitely from India, because I remember having that conversation. The woman who edited my book and prepared it for the store was from Britain. Like, it was just, and I got it all done in a week, which was also insane. I had put off this book because in my head, I'm like in this weird, because I have maybe that old soul or old mentality, I'm like in this weird place where I'm like, I just think things have to be done this certain way. So I put it off, where I procrastinated, and Rich was actually present when it happened, because I was talking to him on Slack. I'm like, all right, this is the weekend. I'm going to start getting the book, and I'm getting the book published and done. I'm going to get it out. And I'm thinking this is going to be a 3-month process. And I'm seeing like publishing machines going off, like some kind of old school 1960s movie in black and white or something to that effect. And then I got online, and it took me like 48 hours to locate all these people, to not only that, see their portfolio, negotiate a price, as you said, discuss with them. And I think, what, Rich, like by Sunday I had the book published and ready to go.
Yeah. And you were
like,
angry.
It happened.
And
so
you were
fast.
Angry about it too.
It happened so fast. We had to slow down. He's like, whoa, maybe we should like do one more read. And like, we had enough time to do another edit of the book before it released. And it's just crazy to me now. And maybe that's like so casual to folks. And I think that's what you see. And that's why I'm asking, this generation, I think I don't think I have as much conflict, which is why it's maybe personally offensive to me when I read all these millennial articles, when I'm managing millennials. I don't run into issues with managing millennials other than maybe general workplace frustrations. I'm actually beholden to rules that are more frustrating me. So when they ask me that why, I'm like, yeah, I'm wondering why too. It's not that I'm mad at them for asking why. I'm like, yeah, go ask them why. And when you get the answer, come let me know, because I don't understand either. I'm just trying to follow these rules that I kind of have to tote the line on behalf of the company. But I also question myself, but maybe not as loudly and frequently as themselves.
Yeah, it's all about expectations.
All right? So, along that line, what would you offer for peace negotiations between the generations?
Well, one of the important things that you have to understand is we all have different communication styles. So the way I explain this is, if I go back to my parents' generation, when they left home, they wrote letters in cursive. The first generation to have long distance, have phones, was the silent generation, those born during the Depression. And we used to have things like long distance calling cards. So the idea is, my parent generation communicated in a written form. Both the silent and baby boomers were auditory generations. We like to be talked to.
Okay.
As you start getting folks in Gen X, which is 35 to 50 something, they were the first ones that have electronic communications. And then the kids today, they text, which is kind of written. And here's the key point. If I want you to listen to me, I have to adapt to you, which says I, as a boomer, if I've got a 25-year-old, I have to learn how to communicate with them electronically. At the same time, if you're a 25-year-old and you got a 50-year-old boss, you need to go talk to them.
That's interesting. And I hope this works, because I'm about to walk through an exercise, then I'm going to make a point. It's actually something my friend told me because we're going through this existential crisis. And I can't tell if we're midlife, but we're definitely close. And we've definitely been acting like we're going through a midlife crisis for about 15 years. And I think that speaks to the speed in which you take in knowledge makes you feel older than you may be on paper. So I want you to, and our listeners, let's say you were telling somebody using your hand that you were writing a letter. Go ahead and motion how you would demonstrate that you were writing a letter. And my friend, having done that exercise, said he was talking to his nephew, and his nephew was like, yeah, man, I was writing this girl. And he took his hands and he thumbed like he was sending a text message.
Yep.
And he's like, wait, you wrote her? He goes, yeah, man, I was writing her. He goes, no, you wrote her. And he's like moving his hand like a pen. And like they do that so infrequently that if they want to represent writing someone, they act like they're texting. When he told me this, I was like, I was shocked and appalled.
Well, let me give you another example. I did a workshop for a nationwide staffing company, and we were in Tampa, Florida, and they were all flew in, and there were about 200 of them. About 90% were boomers. So I noticed the day before when I flew in late that afternoon, I noticed that they were all texting their kids back home. So when I got to the point of the workshop where I said, okay, how many of folks, you know, how many of folks are boomers? How many of you have kids? And then how many of you text your kids? And about every hand of the room went up. And I went, okay, you modified your communication style for your children. Are you willing to do it for your younger employees? Huh, and I left it.
That's nice.
And you could feel it go through the room. Oh, crap, he's right. And so we end up with a lot of business practices that are based on my generation boomers, that the reality is it's your generation that's going to take over. Mm. And the key piece is we all have to adapt to everyone else. This is no different. I spent 4 years training engineers in China, in the People's Republic of China. I did not expect them to behave like Westerners. I had to adapt to their learning style, which was very different than any engineer I would have trained in Europe or in the US. Mm. So it's we have a greater range in age in the workforce today than we've ever had before. And all of us have different communication styles, and we all have to adapt to each other.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. We touched on this a little bit, and someone else pointed this out in a much better way than I'm going to articulate right now, so I apologize going in. That's my disclaimer. there's going to be a gulf, and I guess it's twofold. So the way they explained it is there's a large, and you talked about the number of children that were born. That's what we were talking about, birth control at the time. But there's this huge influx I think it's the baby boomers, might have been the generation before, of literally just by numbers of people born. And then an hourglass, it thins, and then you have millennials. So there's going to be a gulf of, you know, retirement. I think they said they're eligible to retire like 10,000 every month. Like everyone will age into retirement age. Now, whether they retire or not remains to be seen, because maybe you can talk to that. I don't see y'all retiring. Like, I literally do not see y'all retiring at these numbers that they say you're going to retire, because most seem to be staying for either themselves or for other purposes. But also what I'm seeing is, so let's say you do retire and all those management and upper level positions open up. What I've seen, I talked to Rich about this on a previous show, is millennials don't want their jobs. They're like, I don't want to work 60 hours. I don't care how much you pay me or what you throw at me. Maybe, like we talked about, if you let me work from home and I show up at whatever hour. But I've had several, like, almost exhaustive conversations with younger people, and they're just like, my goal is not management. They might want good money. They might want flexible benefits, work-life balance. But I'm like, oh, well, what about management? They're like, nah, I'm good. Because either they don't want to manage people, or maybe they just have a negative connotation of what they see management is, which is usually, you know, 60, 50 unpaid hours after a while. Are you seeing that as well?
Well, let me take the first one. Boomers. Okay. We are not going to retire the way our parents did, for multiple reasons. Number one, there are a lot of us don't want to. I left the corporate world 4 years ago to start my career pivot business because I could. And I got sick of working for the man. And my goal is to work less on my terms and never, quote, fully retire like my parents did. On the other hand, the vast, vast, vast majority do not have the money to retire on. The average boomer has like $80,000 saved for retirement.
How much was that? Well, you said 80?
80,000.
Okay.
Now, today, if you're a married couple in 65, the odds, there's a 75% chance that one of you will live past 95.
Wow. Okay. Sorry.
Right?
I was like, that probably won't be me.
Well, yeah. but the way I other explain this is when the golden years came about, which was in the late 50s and early 60s. Think about this. There was a great visionary in 1960, a guy named Del Webb. He started Sun City in Arizona. Okay. January 1, 1960, he opened up Sun City with five model homes and a strip mall. He had 10,000 cars outside his doorstep on day one. Now think about all, this is 1960. Of all those people coming in that first day, how many of those do you think of those people smoked?
Probably a good number of them.
Probably a lot. They didn't live all that long, right? So we're going to live a lot longer. And by the way, we don't have the money to retire. The other piece of that is the Generation X, those between 35 and 50 something, that's a very small generation. Only about 55 million were born. And that's largely because their parents' generation, those born during the Depression and World War II, is also a very small generation. But if you look at the census data, they're almost 80 million. So where did the other 25 million come from? Well, it was the other 25 million are all there because they're all immigrants. Mm. And 1965, there was the Immigration Act that allowed educated Asians to immigrate, made it much easier for them to immigrate. So we have, if you look at Gen X, they don't look like boomers at all. And the way I explain this is we had three Gen X presidential candidates this year. Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, and Bobby Jindal. The commonality is they all had immigrant parents.
I never put that together.
Okay. So if you look at Gen X, they don't look anything like the previous generation. And then you start looking at millennials or Gen Y, and, you know, we have, you know, our current president is, you know, he was African father, white mother. We're going to see the blending. And so the values of Gen Y or millennials is really different. They don't look like my generation. Mm-hmm. And by the way, they're just fine. In fact, it's my belief they're going to change the way the workplace looks, in my opinion, probably for the better. Now, in the same way, it scares the crap out of us.
Now, well, isn't 2040 supposed to be the year that essentially all minority groups become the majority?
That I don't know. I know they're talking about, you know, here in Texas, we will become a Hispanic majority state, I don't know, 2025.
Yeah.
I know that, you know, soon.
Yeah, it's, if you want to get into politics with Trump, this is probably the last gasp of the fact that, you know, we're rapidly no longer going to be a white majority country. It's just the demographics are just striking. And by the way, if you go historically and look at immigration into the U.S., we, every time a new immigrant group came in, the folks here didn't like it. Whether it was the Irish, whether it was the Polish, whether it was the Germans, no one liked it who was here. But the problem we have today is you guys, you're not having kids. We have the lowest, birth rate we've ever had. And some of this comes out of the Great Recession. And I need someone to pay my Social Security.
So
we actually need immigration.
Yeah. What I was going to ask there is for, I guess I'm going to call it action items. I know that sounds cliche as I don't know what, but you know, I'm corporate, so it is what it is. I'm becoming the man behind the curtain and in some ways the man, like the man that you fight against, ladies and gentlemen, I will say, over time, you try to fight the tide, but unless you work for self, which I advocate for, you become that person. Like I never thought of myself as management. I actually still have trouble saying it at work. Like I garble through it. I'm like, yeah, you know, management. They're like, you? I'm like, management has this initiative. They're like, are you talking in the third person? But what advice would you offer folks for their career or action items in their 20s that would be different or like for their 30s that would be different or like for their 40s? Like what by decade maybe approaches should they be taking?
Well, number one, you cannot look at your career as one and done. Right? You say, well, I'll pick the career and I'll do it the rest of my life. Today, it's a combination of what you're interested in. And by the way, your interests will change as you age.
Yeah.
Two, you have to understand that the market is constantly changing. So it's kind of like what you're interested in and what will the market pay for? And so it's a matter of, it's not so much your 20s, 30s, and 40s, and 50s. It's more about staying on top of changes. I have a blog post where I talk about has your job been smacked? And I call SMAC stands for social, mobile, analytics, and cloud.
So those are all of the current things that seem to be the wave, right?
They are changing things. So simple things like, one of the things we're seeing in the economy is, we've seen the fight for 15. As we raise the minimum wage, which we're going to do, is what it's going to do is it's going to bring in more automation. So why can't you on your smartphone order your burger at P. Terry's or Whataburger or whatever, and just drive up to the window and it's there and you already paid for it? It's easy to eliminate jobs in certain service sectors.
Sorry, you really brought it home for me because I think I had Whataburger this weekend. So
I was like, that would be so convenient.
Yeah, yes. I definitely ordered Taco Bell and then went to pick it up like a few days ago.
So the idea is, and this rate of change isn't going to slow down. So, okay, how are you going to continually stay competitive and be able to continue to pivot as you get older and your interests change and your values to some extent change? We all mature as we grow older, and what we want to do when we're 25 is not necessarily what we want to do at 45.
So how does someone dual prepare for those? Or I guess it would be this was said this way. How does someone prepare for those dualities? So how do you prepare yourself for a changing market and then be ready to move when that opportunity comes?
Okay. Number one, you've got to be self-aware. And it's paying attention to where your interests lie. The second is you can't get lazy. I use this, you can't be a turkey. And I use the turkey analogy is turkeys are raised in here in the US in sterile environments. The butcher takes really good care of them. And for 3 years, every day is better than the last until the fourth Thursday in November in that third year when suddenly you're a turkey, which says you have to pay attention. You have to pay attention to market trends. You have to understand what things are people are willing to pay for. I use example. I've got a 67-year-old client who was a Microsoft engineer, and he used to make decent money putting in Exchange servers and, SharePoint and putting servers in place in small businesses, locations. All that's moved to the cloud.
And I was going to ask you, and I've said this on the show, and I got a little bit of flack for it, but one of the pieces of advice I offer people who want to make money is to chase money. So if you are interested in money, and I think some people, the reason the flack I got is, oh, it's not all about money, happiness, participation trophies, blah, 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 blah. And that's good and that's fine and dandy. But if you want to make money, I think a lot of people take the approach of, well, this is interesting to me, pay me for it, versus what are people paying for? Do my interests align with that?
It's what society values and is willing to pay for.
And that's what you should, I guess, target your career. I'm not telling people to only pick careers they blatantly hate and dislike that pay well, but to look in career areas aligned with your interests that pay well. Whereas I hear people pick interests in poor paying careers. And then they're like, well, why am I making any money? I'm like,
Okay. Here's the reason why they do that is, as a boomer, I was told to go to school, get a job, go to work. You'll be happy when you retire. Gen Xers, because they watched their parents being miserable. So they said, you know what? I'm going to be really successful. And when I'm successful, I'll be happy. Well, that didn't work either. So what did our kids do? They said, I'll follow my passion. The money will follow. And that didn't work either. So it's a cross section between what you're interested in and what society values. It's a cross section.
Yeah. And I feel like something that we've seen a lot of over the past few years is this idea of the rise of the personal brand, which has this entrepreneurial component tied to it. And I'm listening to this and I'm like, this kind of sounds like what you hear a lot of people saying these days, where maybe they have a day job or maybe they are entrepreneurial, but there's this whole idea of, you know, I need to present myself as the skill set and try to make that work for whatever it is that I want to do, and then hope that that thing makes me some money. So what was that personal brand element, something that existed before that maybe people didn't vocalize, or is that something that you think is more specific to this generation?
Personal brand is not generational. It is, the difference is in when I started, my personal brand was my reputation. And the people who knew my reputation were people I worked with and in the people who I directly interacted with. Well, now with the internet, I interact with people all over the world. Oh, by the way, I'm competing with people all over the world. And so your personal brand, I don't care whether you're an entrepreneur or you're an employee, you're competing for the job with people all over. And you have to create this brand, which, by the way, pisses a lot of folks of my age off, because I'm not a product.
You know what? I still hear a lot of people in this generation say that too. There's people who get really fired up about this brand conversation for the same reason that you're saying. So it's not just y'all.
Well, that was going to be my question, because. IBM. Sorry, now that I'm saying that out loud. I can't remember her name. I want to say it was a CEO, but the issue was because of that, and maybe that's that misunderstanding, because I'm not sure if millennials agree with that. Like, I think most millennials think at five. So you own, or I work for you from 8 to 5 or 9 to 5. At 5:01, what I do on Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat is my business until 8 a.m. the next day. Do you think that's accurate? Because I think a lot of companies now try to hold people accountable for what would have been traditional after work hours. But the workday now, as you mentioned, is so non-traditional and or never ends.
Yeah, the key piece here is, when you get on Twitter or Facebook or Snapchat, you are you're a publisher. And by the way, that doesn't go away. In fact, I did a review on a really good book called The Reputation Economy. We have reached a point where it is now more expensive to delete data than to add more storage. So as you publish things, i.e. on Facebook, you make comments. Yes, you will eventually be rated on that. Oh, you go down to, you order that big, huge burger down at, Hardee's. Will that have effect on your health insurance prices?
Oh, wow.
Okay. Well, you will be rated. And well, how will they know? They'll know because you probably put it on your charge card.
Yeah. And I could see that because someone was telling me, I didn't put this together. I actually stopped filling it out as a result of this. So for like 2 or 3 years, they were like, hey, fill out this survey. You'll get, $100, blah, 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 blah. And everyone, fill it out. And then one day somebody who works for the healthcare company is like, yeah, we use those surveys to determine your health plans for the next few years. So we save money by because everybody was wondering, like, why are they just giving money away? But they actually save money by having more data to do like an actuarial analysis of basically the healthcare needs and demographic of the workplace. Then, of course, everyone became paranoid, stopped filling out the surveys.
Yeah, it's if you think that the days of privacy are gone, it is everything you do, you know, unless you're getting smart about how you use your smartphone. I'll use the example. I've got a client who teaches at University of Texas, and somebody went in and changed a professor's grade book, and they knew exactly who it was because at 3 a.m. they knew exactly who was on the Wi-Fi. Their phone in their pocket got picked up by the Wi-Fi, and they knew exactly who it was.
That sounds like a Law & Order SVU episode where they triangulate the towers and figure out who it was.
Yeah, I mean, the world of work is changing rapidly. And so to get back to the point is you got to stay on top of what's changing. Your job, if they suddenly call you up and suddenly say, you know what, we're shipping your job to the Philippines, you had better well be prepared for that. You don't want to be a turkey.
Nice. And to help with that, I think that's a great segue. So we wanted to talk a little bit about, the best way I'm going to describe it is the tool that you have, Career Pivot, which helps baby boomers design careers they can grow into for the next 30 years. So how do you begin preparing for a second career or career transition, and how does Career Pivot help with that?
Well, number one, I put everybody through my Career Pivot evaluation, which is really the Berkman assessment with my technology stuff on top. I want you to be aware of what you've done to yourself, which most of us I'm actually shifting down to what I refer to as the second half of life, which is you getting down into the 40 somethings of understanding, number one, how have you changed? Many of us, as we go into the workforce, we change our behaviors because our employers want us to change our behaviors. I'm a closet introvert. I'm a phenomenally good public speaker. I'm great at a networking event. The difference is when I walk out, my knees buckle. I'm exhausted.
I know the feeling, bro. I know the feeling.
I am not an extrovert, but I've learned I have to behave like one. Well, I want you to understand. Similarly, I end up with a lot of closet creatives, a lot of folks who have high artistic, musical, and literary interests and have taken it and shoved it because they can't make money at it and made themselves miserable. And so I want to get you to understand who you are, and then we start targeting to where you want to go. And usually it's where you want to go next, right? And pointing you in the direction. And by the way, your next job is not going to come from applying online. It's building your personal brand, building out on social media, and more importantly, targeting companies that are capable of hiring you. So one way to look at yourself, and this is for anyone of any age, you have to understand what problems you solve. In many ways, you're a consultant for your employer. You solve their problems. So get real clear on what problems do you solve. And then you can target companies that have those problems.
That's excellent advice. And I mean, I'm not being facetious. I literally mean that, because it reminded me, I'm in this General Assembly data analytics certification program right now. And some of the listeners are familiar with that and probably take a show to talk about that in more detail. But our quote unquote professor, who is really a real world in the market working for, I won't say his company because I'm not sure he wants me to put that information out there, but he's working for a company, like he does it. Like you said, some teachers don't do it. Like he's more or less teaching about the job he has right now. But one thing he said in one of the classes I thought was fascinating that ties to this subject is he said his last three jobs, he writes the job description and sends it in. They modify it and they hired him. And he said that's what he's done for his last three jobs. He worked for himself before that. And yeah, well, I thought that was amazing.
I've got three clients right now who are all dating to get a job. And what I mean by that is they've gone to the company and saying, hey, let me come in as a consultant or contractor for 3 months and let's work on this project. Mm-hmm. And they proposed it.
Well, that's interesting, because one of the models that we see out there is, you know, there's a ton of headhunters and staffing agencies, and there are a lot of people who are were risk averse. And when they hear the word contract or contract to hire, they're like, yeah, I'm only looking for full time. So for someone who's in a situation where, you know, maybe they're having trouble finding work, or they have some freedom where they can afford to take a chance, do you have any advice for them as it comes to contract opportunities specifically, given some people have a negative connotation in mind when they hear that?
Well, you've got to get away from, a lot of us want full-time employment because we want security. I'm sorry, the secure job is dead. Mm-hmm. Right? It's gone. So it's getting, particularly, I've had multiple clients where we'll come in, they'll interview, and the hiring folks will say, maybe. And it's like, no, turn around and say, let me come in and do this job for 3 months at this rate. And what that does is it allows them to put a box around it and say, okay, here's how much money I'm going to spend. And in the end, we both have the right to walk away. This is both a good thing for the employer and it's a good thing for the employee. But you as a, you know, looking for a job, you got to get creative.
Yeah.
And right. And it also allows you to walk in saying, hey, do I want to work here? It gives you a chance to date. You know, admittedly, I've been married 35 years, so it's been a long time since I dated. But it's, you know, you're both of you going to put your best foot forward, and you are going to, number one, it lets you go in and show your value. And by the way, probably negotiate a higher pay. And it also allows you, this really sucks, allows me to walk away. Allows me to walk away gracefully. And yeah. this is particularly when those of us who, as we get in our 50s and 60s, where, you know, people go, I don't want to hire him. Oh, well, let me show you my value.
To that point, do you think this is something that would work for younger folks? And I ask that because they're not going to have that, you know, well-developed resume, that lengthy career service. Or do you see this as, you know, truly a second, maybe third, fourth, or career?
It's harder to do when you're young, partially because a lot of folks don't have the confidence to do this. But no, this can be done at any level and at any time. But it's doing the appropriate homework to know, again, it's the problems I solve versus problems the hiring manager has.
Yeah, okay.
Be able to match that. And that's harder to do when you're young, because as I claim, you know, when you're young, you don't know what you don't know.
Okay.
Right. It's experience. So at what point can you get there? It depends. There's no hard, fast answer.
Now, I'm really glad you said that, because as a recruiter, and I know we're moving to the wrap up here, but as a recruiter, I see a lot of candidates across generations, but particularly, you know, folks who are generation, who are millennials and whatever this next one is, where you can tell that they take one resume and they submit that one resume to a bunch of different types of jobs versus actually looking at the job description, figuring out kind of where their skills align, or if there are skills that they have are transferable, and then sending a more tailored version of that resume out. So do you have any advice or words for those folks who are like, you know, I've been applying to jobs for a while. I'm tired of having to create these different versions of my resume. I just want to have one thing and go forward with it. If the company likes it, great. If not, I'm going to keep on applying.
Okay. Hiring is all about risk mitigation. The safest hire is an internal candidate.
Yep.
The second safest hire is an external candidate with an employee referral. So the first thing you do when you see a job posted is you go find someone who works at that company and work on trying to get a referral.
Yeah.
Right. And hopefully you've already targeted that company's already on your target list, and you should already have someone who can refer you in. I claim if the first time someone meets you is via your resume in an applicant tracking system, sorry, you lose. Mm. It's working the relationships. This is one of the challenges the millennials have, is they think, my son was like this when he graduated from college 10 years ago. Oh, I'm just going to apply online and it's just magic going to happen. Nope. He got a bunch of job interviews across the country. Why? All through relationships. Most of the time it was through my Northwestern alumni directory, where, you know, I reached out in his favor for him and said, hey, my son turned into a decent human being. Can you help him? Right.
We definitely talk a lot about the importance of networking on the show. And I think, what do you call it, Rich? The shadow market?
Oh, the hidden job market.
There we go.
I mean, 60-80% of jobs never get posted.
I agree. I see it every day.
You know, I pitched a presentation last year to South by Southwest on the what I called social disruption, how social media has disrupted the job search. You know, today most companies of any size go out and look for, they source people. They don't care whether you're looking for a job. They want to find the best candidate. So it's a matter of being what I refer to as a good passive candidate. Having yourself out there, both on LinkedIn, you know, if you're a coder, you better have stuff on GitHub. If you're a marketer, you better have stuff on SlideShare, and make it easy to be found. It's all about being found.
So true. It's so true. Go ahead, Marcus.
Go ahead. No, I was going to move on. So if you have a comment, go ahead. Well, I want to take a brief pause there so we can break this up.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say real quick, because part of what I do is look at folks or look for folks on LinkedIn from the back end. And I try to tell job seekers, like, you have to think like a recruiter or think like a hiring manager, because, you know, if you don't have certain words in your profile or your social presence doesn't tell a certain story, you could be costing yourself an opportunity and not even know it, because there's people out here every day who are looking for folks that have these different backgrounds. But if you're not on the platforms where these people are, and you don't have your profile set up in such a way that it's easy for these people to search and find you, you could be missing out on interviews. You could be missing out on potential offers and not know it because you're not being proactive about those steps. So,
well, it's interesting. I have a blog post out there that's been very popular on why are you not being found? Try thinking like a recruiter. And it's how recruiters use keywords, how they use the current job title. This is a challenge for many of my folks at my job club, is they're unemployed and they don't have a current job title. So I tell them, go create a current job. Maybe a fictitious company, but recruiters typically are looking for a job title and keywords in a geographic region. So you think about, how do these sourcers find people and reverse engineer it? I can't tell. I'm a recovering engineer.
Yeah, I can tell.
Right? And you, once you think about how they do that, and if you don't have a current job, you will not be found.
Yeah, it is a huge factor. So I would say, you know, the idea of someone creating a fictitious company. Are there other things that you've seen people do that look appropriate? So if someone doesn't have a job right now, are there things that you've seen be effective for people other than put consultant? And then when a recruiter drills down, it turns out, you know, they haven't been doing anything. So are there any quick tips you could give for people who might be in that situation for things that they could say that wouldn't potentially cost them the opportunity later because it came across as less than truthful?
Well, number one, you have to be truthful. So what I always tell people is you should create your own LLC that you always have. And anytime you're unemployed, that's your current job. And yes, you should be doing all your contract work, your consulting work through that. I used to have a consulting company called Global Basis Consulting. And that was always on my LinkedIn profile and it always popped to the top. And one of the key things is when put in for your current job title, you put every variation of the job title you want. In the post, I'll send you a link to this post.
Perfect.
I talk about product managers. I've dealt with a lot of product managers. If you'd put product manager as your job title. But by the way, if you also do product marketing, you put product manager, vertical bar, space, product marketing, or product marketer, or product marketing manager. And the key piece here is you have to be honest. You can't lie. But if you tell me all the different titles so you can be found.
There it is.
Right? How do I make myself findable?
And to that point, where can people find you?
You can find me at careerpivot.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at careerpivot. Again, I've made every career list of Twitter that you can find.
I just saw you in one like literally 2 weeks ago, a list came out and I was like, oh, he's going to be on the show soon. So yeah, I can co-sign that.
Yeah, no, and you can also, if you go to my website, go click on the contact me. You can click on that, or I also have a contact career pivot tab on both the right side and the bottom of the webpage. And I respond to that. I even have my phone number on my website.
Oh, in 2016.
Yeah. Now you'll get a kick. I had a blog post go viral several years ago on the five things on your resume that make you appear too old. The first one was an AOL email address.
I got to
agree. Second was put your home address. Huh. Third was putting your home telephone number on it. The fourth was obsolete skills. And I said I was an MS-DOS control programmer. And the last one is the one that caused it to go viral to about 750,000 views. It was two spaces after a period.
Oh, man. I we don't have enough time for me to go into this today.
I got hate mail over that.
Oh, yeah. You've got to send us that link so we can include that.
Oh, well, you would have thought I told them to draw comics of Muhammad. I mean, I had people sending me hate mail. You know, how dare you say that?
That's the first time I've heard that one, which is interesting. But Marcus, it sounds like you feel passionately about it, which we'll have to discuss offline.
I've had whole days, multiple lost to one space, two space period debates. So, yeah, I definitely can't close that out at the end of this podcast.
Well, hey, Mark, it's been great having you on the podcast. It's probably the most lengthy discussion that we had about the millennial boomer divide. And it's quite fitting since, you know, you're speaking to folks who have worked across generations. And then, of course, the career advice on the tail end of the show. We definitely appreciate that. And I'm sure our listeners will get value from that, as well as the articles that we're going to link to in the show notes. So, yeah, again, thanks for coming on. It's been great having you here.
Hey, no problem. And every time someone complains about the millennials, I just, particularly boomers, I tell them they is the way they is because we made them that way.
Yeah, it's true. And it has me thinking about what I'm going to teach my kids, because I'm like, all right, how much pain do I want to experience in 20 years where I have to like eat my own words? So definitely appreciate that too.
It's kind of like when I was teaching high school and my kids that were asking me basically, did you smoke weed? Child of the 60s and 70s. And my response was yes, when I was young and stupid.
But I didn't inhale. That's what I
didn't inhale.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I'm gonna say because I was in California. But anyway, I'd like to thank everyone who's been listening to this episode. If you have topics you'd like to hear us cover or thoughts, you can email us at info@paychecksandbalances.com.
And don't forget to join our email list where we share top articles we read throughout the week, work and money tips, and much, much more. You can sign up by visiting paychecksandbalances.com/email.
Yes, you can. And so again, thanks to everyone for listening. Until next time, be safe. We out. Peace.